This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Debate in Congress. Clayton Morgridge will explore the latest hot button question, when can your government kill you? I will talk about the recent passing of Violence Against Women Act and its meaning for American Indian women. And Tom Becker will read an essay by Noam Chomsky. If we have time, which I believe we will, there will be some live recordings from the postal workers' rally that happened here in Portland over the weekend, and maybe we'll hear some poetry. It is the old mole variety hour, a vaudeville of politics and progressive thought. Hold still and stay tuned.
Hello, friends! Did you see my hat move around? It's fun to move around. Let's all play a game where we can move around and hold still. Hey, Plex, let's all play Hold Still.
Attention, everyone, it's fun game time, it's fun game time. Okay, everyone, it's time to play a game. Here's how we play. When I say wiggle, you move around and go crazy. And when I say hold still, you hold still like a statue. Got it? Okay, let's play. Here we go. 4, 3, 2, 1. Hold still.
Now that we've got some of our wiggles out, let's hold still and listen to Bill Resnick discuss three compelling federal budget proposals recently unveiled. And he'll be talking with economist Ellen Franks of U Massachusetts in Boston. They critique the Republican and Democratic proposals and support the Congressional Progressive Caucus proposal that Bill says, quote, taxes the ever-growing wealth of the top dogs and actually goes some way towards the transformation so necessary. Let's hear it, Bill.
Ellen Frank, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Ellen Frank teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. She's an associate of a wonderful, useful magazine, Dollars and Cents. She writes on U.S. economic policy. Ellen Frank, last week, three very different competing U.S. federal budgets were proposed. Budgets, of course, are not just numbers. They're policy documents that reflect the values and ideals and premises that the budget proposers are pushing. Ellen Frank, tell us about the three budget proposals and the ideas and values they promote.
Well, the first budget proposal is from the House of Representatives from the Republican Congressional Caucus, put out by Paul Ryan, and it basically would reduce the top marginal tax rate to 25%, which is the lowest it's ever been historically, and would eviscerate Medicare, food stamps, Pell Grants, unemployment insurance, and virtually all the programs that working class and middle class depend upon. The other budget is put out by the Senate, which has put out a sort of middle-of-the-road budget, which does not make any significant cuts in Medicare or Social Security except to reduce Medicare spending by more efficient and effective billing and affordable care practices. And then the final budget is put out by the Progressive Caucus. They're calling it the People's Budget. And this would give a big stimulus boost to the economy in the next couple of years by spending almost $2 trillion in the next couple of years on infrastructure, on teachers, on block grants to states so they can hire back firefighters and policemen and reopen libraries that have been closed during this last recession. It would also spend a lot on infrastructure, on green energy, and it would pay for this by raising the top tax rate on millionaires and billionaires and doing away with certain exemptions and tax loopholes that benefit primarily the rich, like the so-called carried interest exemption. So those are the three competing budget proposals, and they reflect, obviously, the three different values about, or especially the Progressive Caucus's budget and the Republican budget, reflect the different values that they have about government and what the role of government should be in the economy and how, what responsibility we have to one another as citizens of the country, what responsibility we have to the poor, to the sick, to the vulnerable. So these are competing ideologies, in a sense.
Right. The Republicans, of course, have a set of economic theories that justify this in the name, however, of the poor, right? They knew nothing is done in Washington now if it's in fact not going to somehow benefit poor people in the long run. And they believe that an austerity budget and enriching the rich further, as if the companies don't have enough money, will somehow lead to much more investment, more jobs, a more vibrant economy. It's quite absurd. But
Well, we have the evidence of Europe right in front of us, where Greece and Spain and Italy have passed austerity budgets, and also Ireland. Their economies have suffered. They are now encountering depression levels of unemployment, with unemployment in Spain and Greece at about 25% of the population, in Ireland about 17% of the population. The austerity budget that the UK has passed has led to a recession in that country and 10 or 11% unemployment. And so what we see is that an austerity budget simply does not work. If the investment were to be forthcoming, it would be forthcoming. Right now we have in this country a problem where businesses are sitting on enormous pools of profits and pools of cash that they will not invest, not because they don't trust the government, but because they don't trust the economy.
Because there's insufficient demand to buy those products, right? I mean, it seems to me
they don't trust that the demand is going to be there, that the consumer spending is going to be there, and so they're not investing, and that's dragging the economy down further. And so, you know, when businesses don't invest and private resources lay dormant, you know, workers don't have jobs, you know, construction workers are sitting idle, factories are sitting idle, hotels are sitting empty. When all of these things are sitting empty and are sitting idle, that's the time that you need government to step in and utilize these resources that the private sector is letting languish.
What about their argument that this deficit is killing us, and if we just keep printing dollars, we're going to inflate the currency enormously and bring down the economy, or we'll suffer like many other countries, go into a deep debt crisis and be unable to, in fact, even attract and have any investment? All of it's bogus. Why don't you tell us why?
Well, I mean, there are economic theories, and economics is not a science where you can have controlled experiments. So what we look at is what's actually happened in this country and in other countries when we have run large deficits. We can take the experience, for example, of Japan. Japan has been running huge deficits for a number of years. Their debt-to-GDP ratio is 2.3. Ours is about 100%, actually less than that when you consider debt that's not held by the public. But and what's happened to them is that their currency is too strong. They actually are trying to intervene in the currency markets to weaken their currency because it's hurting their exports significantly. Their inflation rate is too low, and they're actually trying to bring up inflation to get the economy growing a little faster. And there's no problem with them getting people to buy the debt or to hold the debt. And the evidence of that is that interest rates are so low in Japan. Interest rates are also low in the United States, despite the large deficit, because the banks and other institutions would much rather hold government debt, which is the safest debt available, than they would to hold private sector debt, where there's risk of losses and risks of bankruptcies and risks of foreclosures. And banks are still not ready to dip their toes in the water and make loans to private businesses and private individuals after the crash of 2008.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Ellen Frank, who is an engaged economist who writes on budget policy. Ellen Frank, I gather you support the Progressive Caucus budget.
I think it's a great budget. I think it's got no chance of getting passed through this legislature.
Right. On the other hand, it seems to me that it might be a basis for talking about the economy in a way that popular movements might pick up as the sort of the economy gets ground down and the wealthy get wealthier and the poor get more insecure. It seems to me it's always good to have a proposal on the table. Let's talk about it a little bit and the kinds of things that should be done with it.
Well, one of the proposals in that Progressive Caucus budget is that taxes go up on people with incomes over $1 million and up further on people with incomes over $1 billion. And that seems to me an excellent idea. One of the problems in this country is that income has become incredibly maldistributed. In the last 2 years, 93% of the benefits of economic growth, that virtually all of it, went to 1% of the population. What's been happening is that as the economy grows, instead of everybody's incomes growing, we're only seeing growth at the top 1 or 2 or 3 or 5% of the income distribution. Everybody else's income is lagging behind. And anything that would redistribute income in this country would be beneficial, not just in moral terms, but in terms of better able to finance progressive programs like Social Security, like Medicaid, like Medicare, better able to finance the health care subsidies that are going to be part of the Affordable Care Act when it goes into effect next year. We'd be better able to do a lot of things if we had the revenues, and the only place to get the revenues is from that top 1% who are controlling a larger and larger share of the nation's income.
The progressive budget for me was, of course, a welcome, but it was relatively disappointing. It spoke in Beltway terms, in Washington terms, in budgetary terms. There was very little visionary in it. It was really focused on getting people back to work, which, of course, is a wonderful thing. And without work, and especially insecure work, it is really demoralizing, and it undermines people, particularly when they're not even sure of health care. It's an enormous burden on people's lives, and it's reflected in so many ways. A full employment economy would be a very different world, and it's something really to be desired. But there are other needs within the United States. Things could be so much better for the great majority of people, and in the future as well, if we dealt strongly and in a powerful and sort of crusading ways to deal with climate change, environmental pollution, and if we made attempts to democratize our institutions, have a very different sort of transportation system, very different ways of managing our companies, managing productive enterprises, not companies, different forms of agriculture, which would be good for the environment. It seems to me we really, those are enormous needs that are looming over the United States, and yet the budgeteers don't seem to want to talk in that language. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, a budget is a limited item. I mean, a budget is about what the government's going to spend money on, and it's incredibly important from a policy perspective because it basically says this is what's important to us to spend money on. This is what our values are. Now, getting people back to work, I think, is a precondition for any of the other kinds of large visionary ideas that somebody might have, because people simply are too cautious and too insecure to support changes that might negatively affect them in the short run. It would be beneficial to the environment in the long run if they don't have jobs. If people were more secure in their livelihoods, then something like increasing the tax on carbon and fossil fuels and, you know, imposing carbon taxes or restricting the use of carbon-based fuels in utilities, all of which are going to be expensive in the short run, is much easier to bear and much easier for people to get behind if they feel that they're economically secure.
Let's talk about the Democratic proposal. My understanding of it is that it's sort of a moderate austerity budget. That is, that the Democrats are seeing a lot of cuts as necessary. They're balancing some additional revenues with considerable cuts. President Obama seems ready to index Social Security. It seems to me a disastrous idea that every year the Social Security payments index the rise in Social Security in a new way that would greatly limit its increase
the
over the years.
The
cost of living adjustment, right.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the budget, whereas it's not nearly as bad as the Ryan budget, and it doesn't stimulate the economy in the way that's necessary to get out of this, and it could, and it ultimately might lead to the people getting tired of the Democrats and going with Mr. Ryan, which seems to be what the Republicans, in fact, think. If they can make things worse and worse and worse under Obama, they might have a good chance of actually taking power.
You're probably right in terms of the kind of cynical political calculations that are behind this. But, you know, it's certainly true that the Senate Democrats and the Obama administration have swayed too easily. Perhaps it's because they are cowardly politically, or perhaps it's because they simply do not hold progressive values. And the fact that they're willing to make compromises, that they're willing to put Social Security on the table, that they're willing to discuss cuts to Medicare, you suggest that people may indeed get angry enough that they just go with the Ryan budget, in which case you're going to see massive cuts in government spending. You know, one of the problems with the Ryan budget is it won't close the deficit, and because it will, the tax cuts are so large that there's simply no way that cuts in government spending are going to make up for that. And that inability to close the deficit is a huge problem in this country. One of the things that Republicans have been very good at doing, first under the Reagan administration, then under the Bush administration, and now under the Ryan budget, if it were to become law, is cutting taxes, creating these huge deficits, and then using the deficit as a political bludgeon to try to force Democrats to cut programs that Democratic voters support by saying that we have to close the deficit. The truth is we don't have to close the deficit. There's nothing wrong with running a deficit at all. We don't see any negative effects on the economy whatsoever. The negative effect on the economy right now is coming completely from the private sector's unwillingness to invest and has nothing to do with the deficit or with government spending. But for years, the right wing has wanted to demolish the New Deal and the Great Society programs, and that includes Social Security, Medicare, unemployment compensation, Medicaid, food stamps, and all these other programs that benefit people who are out of work. And the question that I have is why? Why are they so intent on dismantling these programs? And the only answer that makes sense to me is that they want to pull the floor out from under wages in this country by making it so difficult for people to survive without a job that they'll work for any wage at all, no matter how low, rather than be completely impoverished. So that's the only argument that makes sense to me. It's the only rationale I can see.
It seems to me it's not rational for conservatives to be, in fact, creating an economy that can't possibly work because it's becoming so unequal and leads to all kinds of social dislocations and threats and insecurity and fears and the rise of more and more police force. Ellen Frank, why don't you take the last word? In fact, I'd like to hear you talk about how can the progressive budget be made to be more compelling? How can it be somehow enchanted the way successful political movements need a little enchantment as part of them as well?
You know, I always ask people when they talk about not wanting big government what exactly it is they'd like to see cut. Do they want less repairs to their roads? Do they want potholes in their sidewalks? Do they want street lamps to be turned off at night? What exactly is it that the government does that they disapprove of? And the fact is that most people can't come up with very much, besides perhaps defense spending and warmongering. I think that what we need to be talking in this country about and the conversation we need to have is what a progressive role the government can play in people's lives without interfering with our freedom, without making us less secure. Most government programs are well managed. They are incredibly useful. They're very helpful to people. And the more we have of that, the better off we'd be as a society.
And it would be good, though, to try and somehow democratize a lot more at the local level and give people more of a voice and sort of avoid bureaucratic functioning to the extent possible. Although those are all interesting discussions that we can't have now. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Okay, thank you.
Right, so long.
Bye-bye. Oh, wiggle tail, it's time to hold still again. Here we go. Hold still.
Oh, thanks, Bill. That was Bill Resnick talking with economist Ellen Franks and shedding some light on how budgets are essentially policy documents that everyone should have a stake in. Up next, Clayton Morgeridge explores the details on that burning question, when your government can kill you.
Good morning. Well, because U.S. citizens in the Middle East have been killed by drones operated by the CIA, a few U.S. senators took the occasion of John Brenner's confirmation to be nominated for director of CIA, to raise the question, when can our government just kill us? No notice, no trial. Could it target and kill an American citizen that suspects of supporting Al-Qaeda while he or she is having coffee in Boston? Well, history has brought us to the place where questions like these can be taken seriously. Specifically, the histories of colonialism, post-colonialism, and the European and U.S. exercise of economic, political, and military power for the purpose of making the resources of the Middle East, especially oil, available to the profit-making machinery of the West. The result is a state of long-term conflict in which the rich and powerful nations invade, occupy, and humiliate nations and peoples that are poor in order to enrich and empower the elites of Europe and North America. This conflict promises to go on indefinitely as the ongoing violence from the West produces always new generations of young fighters sworn to revenge and to not let the invaders win. From the Western perspective, the enemy has blended into the general population, and so the need arises to target individuals believed to be combatants, even when they are not actually fighting. Thus, the rise of drone technology for finding and killing single individuals. Well, this is the background of the question posed on the Senate floor by Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and Tea Party Republican Rand Paul, who mounted a 12-hour talking filibuster against the nomination. Writing in Salon, Falguni Sheff says, Paul and others in the Senate asked over and over for confirmation that American citizens were not in danger of being killed on American soil. But there was no challenge to the legality of killing foreigners on American soil, to the kill list, to drone strikes on international soil, and to the arbitrary executions of foreigners deemed a threat. The answer they got from Attorney General Eric Holder was that, quote, in extraordinary circumstances, unquote, the president could indeed authorize drone strikes. In fact, Holder reiterated more precisely that the Obama administration reserved the right to kill Americans engaged in combat on American soil. But, Sheff goes on, given the untrustworthiness of the Obama administration in anything having to do with the global war on terror, Holder's answer should not be reassuring to Americans. What does it mean to be engaged in combat on American soil? Does it mean protest? Dissent? Being Muslim and loud? Standing within 50 feet of the White House with a critical sign? In a world where the mainstream media refuses to be critical watchdogs and whistleblowers are treasonous and betrayers of national security, Holder's answer may have made Rand Paul happy, but the rest of us, especially if we are remotely critical, should be terrified. But where were the Democrats? Instead of expressing outrage, Democrats continued to acquiesce to the White House's radical expansion of executive power. And they turned on Rand Paul, even though his objections should have been shared not just by liberals, but by everyone with even a passing respect for the rule of law. Despite the White House's defiant disregard of procedure, transparency, or accountability, the Democrats disassociated themselves from an important strategic ally, a libertarian who is the only one asking the questions that progressives, Occupy protesters, political dissenters, Muslims, Arab Americans, African Americans, Latinos, South Asians, and undocumented migrants want an answer to. Will the president claim and exercise the power to kill one of us at his and his advisor's discretion? Democrats should have participated in Paul's filibuster until the answer they received was an unconditional no to the question of targeted killings of Americans on American soil. But rather than forming a tactical alliance with Paul, Democrats relinquished yet another chance to do their jobs, to question, challenge, and push back on the Obama administration's unceasing quest for power. However, Joshua Holland, writing on Alternet, has a different view of Ron Paul, pointing out that Paul, quote, has no objection to our actual drone policy. He made no mention whatsoever of the administration's dramatic expansion in the use of drone strikes against non-Americans overseas. His singular focus was on the entirely implausible idea that the military might take out dissident voices in the United States with drone strikes. He even offered up a fantasy of Jane Fonda being blown up while sitting in a cafe. Seriously, if the government were to assassinate U.S. citizens for their political views, don't you think they might choose a somewhat quieter method? Well, a recent report by legal scholars at New York University and Stanford found that our drone program in Pakistan is damaging and counterproductive. The authors noted that while civilian casualties are rarely acknowledged by the U.S. government, there is significant evidence that U.S. drone strikes have injured and killed civilians. Another study by the New York America Foundation, that's the New America Foundation, estimated that only 2% of those killed in American drone strikes fit the definition of senior-level targets. Rather than take issue with Obama's actual drone program, Paul's criticism is animated by the paranoid delusions of the far right, the same apocalyptic visions that animate gun-hoarding survivalists and the militia movement. Paul specifically mentioned the possibility of a democratically elected Adolf Hitler-like figure coming to power in the United States. Looming federal tyranny, against which the only protection is an armed citizenry, is a staple item in the Rand Paul inventory of urgent concerns. Paul does not deserve any praise from progressives for attacking a straw drone from the far reaches of the right. And it's a shame that the discourse has been ceded to him, because we should be having a rigorous debate about Obama's drone program, about its legality, morality, and whether it's creating more terrorists than it kills. And let me add about we need a debate about the continuing subordination of the rest of the world to the interests of the ruling European and U.S. elites. But Joshua Holland goes on, it's not the technology itself. People have been killing people remotely using unmanned aerial vehicles since the Nazis started shooting rockets at London during World War II. But the policy is what we should be debating. There is virtually no transparency or accountability attached to the secretive program. So you can stand with Paul, but doing so is never going to lead to the national discussion we should be having about the widespread use of these flying killer robots and the Western domination of the Middle East. And that's from Joshua Holland, writing on Alternet. And I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And so the time has finally come. The bourgeois CS and wars agree with proletarian blood. And that blood which flows from their pen is the closest that they've ever been to the people. You've been their ashes. Yes, sell your souls. Now we're asking you to add to each chorus your song and protest against injustice, state terror, long the streets of the world for the disempowered.
Thanks a lot, Clayton. You just heard music so far today. That was Anti-Flag, protest song. Before that, we heard Yo Gabba Gabba getting their wiggles out. And yeah, and I would be remiss if I did not take a moment to mention the fact that the pledge drive is coming up. Starts March 21st. And if you like the Old Mole Variety Hour, do be sure and put your money in that hour and call up and pledge. We will have some thank you gifts, books, some very exciting books. I'm not sure what they are, but I'm sure they will be insightful and enlightening. And yeah, so just remember the pledge drive. It's an important time to give money to the station and support the shows that you particularly like and want to see continue on the air. Okay, up next, I'm going to read a piece by Gayasi Ross about the Violence Against Women's Act. In February of this year, Congress passed an extension of the Violence Against Women Act, and the writer Gayasi Ross of Indian Country Today had this to say. There is a fundamental difference between leadership and politics, yet most folks tend to conflate the terms and pretend that they are inextricably linked or even synonymous. They're not the same. Leadership is when a person steps out on a limb, rightly or wrongly, to take a stance to help someone or something. Conversely, politics is essentially finding all the wrong reasons not to do the right thing. An example of conflating politics with the leadership is the NRA's insistence that it's displaying leadership by its unwavering insistence that everything else but guns kill people and that guns are the only thing that definitely does not kill people. Now, there are certainly other factors in gun deaths, but in the same way that it's difficult to make Hamburger Helper without hamburger, it's difficult to have gun deaths without guns. Yet, the NRA cannot concede this pretty simple argument merely because of politics. They have millions of members who won't let them. Life is politics. No one's immune to it. In this lifetime, we've seen politics disguised as leadership justify invading a sovereign nation, Iraq, for a horrible event, 9/11, with which said nation had absolutely nothing to do with it. Politics have also caused Barack Obama to support bills such as FISA, a warrantless surveillance bill that he previously said he would filibuster, that any constitutional law student, much less a constitutional law professor, knows was unconstitutional. We've seen politics continue to justify the murder of children and innocent American by our nation's unwillingness to pass meaningful gun laws. And while it's never a good idea to compare tragedies, 2012 saw one of the biggest tragedies in recent times in the name of politics. 2012 was the year that rape ceased to be an undesirable activity, a crime of moral depravity, for most Republicans in the House of Representatives, and instead became a bargaining chip in a continued war against women. Representatives Cole from Oklahoma, and in all fairness, Representative Issa from California, as well as Representatives Gosar, Ross Lentinen, and Don Young, chose not to play those games. Now it's up to us, everybody who thinks that women should not be raped, to contact all the House Republicans who are playing politics with rape and tell them that this is not acceptable. It's hard to understand why anyone would oppose an act that strengthens penalties for repeat sex offenders and creates a federal rape shield law, which prevents rapists from using survivors' past sexual conduct against them during rape trials, mandates that survivors should not bear the expense of their own rape exams or for service of a protection order, keeps survivors safe by requiring that a victim's protection order will be recognized and enforced in all state, tribal, and territorial jurisdictions within the United States, protects Native women from non-Native rapists by enabling tribal courts to prosecute non-Native folks who live on tribal lands with all the same due process protection of federal courts, including right to counsel. Protect women, including Native women, from rape, and not put women on trial when rapes do happen? That's a good thing, right? Unfortunately, not so for most of the Republicans in the House of Representatives. They generally seem to be incredibly comfortable with the concept of rape. To wit, there was a much publicized incident when former Representative Todd Akin scientifically explained how there is no excuse for abortion ever because a female body shuts down, therefore not allowing pregnancy, quote, if it's a legitimate rape, unquote. By the way, recently, Representative Phil Gingrey of Georgia defended Akin's position. There was even the Republican candidate Richard Murdoch, who said that even when life begins with that horrible situation of rape, that is something that God intended to happen, end quote. Then there was Representative Lamar Smith and the House Judiciary Committee, who killed the Sexual Assault Forensics Evidence Registry Act, also known as SAFER Act of 2012, which made it easier to track down rapists by gathering forensic data after a rape incident. With this repugnant context, it's funny how repugnant and Republican kind of rhyme, it's easy to see why most Republicans in the House of Representatives let the Violence Against Women Act die on the vine. The other provisions, no rape shield, stronger penalties for rapists, full faith and credit for protective orders, was probably offensive enough for House Republicans who wanted to find ways to justify rape. Yet the provisions that allowed tribal courts to protect Native women and prosecute non-Native sexual offenders set these Republicans off. Native women are three times more likely to be assaulted and more than twice as likely to be stalked than any other women in the United States. Yet history and statistics tells us that it would be foolhardy to rely upon U.S. prosecutors to protect Native women. Indeed, U.S. attorneys declined to prosecute some 67% of sexual abuse matters referred to them. Moreover, states simply lack the incentive and oftentimes resources to travel to reservations to prosecute non-Natives that only harm Native people. Some state law enforcement officials agree with the recent comments of a King County, Washington sheriff who said, quote, not to fully investigate rape or sexual assault cases that occurred on the Muckleshoot Indian Reservation because rape happens on reservations all the time. This has created, quote, open season for not many non-Native sexual offenders on reservation lands. Again, one in three Native women will be assaulted sexually in her lifetime, and the vast majority of sexual assaults against Native women, 86%, are committed by non-Native men, an unusual figure because most rapes are intraracial. 69% of rapes of white victims are by whites. 81% of rapes of African Americans are by African Americans. At least 70% of rapes of American Indians are interracial. In a very small nutshell, that is why the Native provisions to the Violence Against Women Act are necessary. More, that is also why the Violence Against Women's Act is necessary for all women. Yet politics will not allow most House Republicans to recognize and or act on this need to protect any women. If you would like to find out more about the issues facing Native women, go to Rock Paper Jet LLC. They are releasing a series of videos concerning the Violence Against Women Act and continuing to tell the story of why Native women specifically deserve to be protected from rape, just like all women deserve to be protected from rape. Another good source of information is Andrea Smith, author of many books including Conquest, Sexual Violence, and American Indian Genocide. She is also a scholar and co-founder of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. You can find a YouTube video of a 2011 lecture where she discussed sexual violence in American Indian communities and the role of sexual violence in genocide. She argues that sexual violence is an inherent part of the colonial project. Ross concludes his essay by stating, quote, we need to vote and organize to vote for the 2014 and 2016 elections. Take notes, find out who supports VAWA, Violence Against Women Act, and get ready to support them in 2014 and 2016. And if they don't support the act, get ready to send money to their opponents. I know this isn't an election year, but we need to let these cavemen know that it isn't acceptable and this is a surefire way. Personally, I am not sure that voting or not voting for these Republicans is a surefire way, but it is a start. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Ivan Hale. That was Ulali, the Mother Tribute. Up next, Tom Becker reads an essay by Noam Chomsky, who asks, can democracy survive capitalism?
Good morning. One of the great myths we've been told all our lives is that democracy and capitalism were inseparable. You couldn't have one without the other. The following is an article by Noam Chomsky, Can Civilization Survive Capitalism?, in which he takes issue with the supposed historical truism. There have been serious debates over the years about whether capitalism is compatible with democracy, Chomsky begins. If we keep to really existing capitalist democracy, RECD for short, the question is effectively answered. They are radically incompatible. Let's keep to the most critical immediate problem that civilization faces, environmental catastrophe. Policies and public attitudes diverge sharply. Researcher Kelly Sims Gallagher finds that 109 countries have enacted some form of policy regarding renewable power. In contrast, the United States has not adopted any consistent and stable set of policies at the national level to foster the use of renewable energy. It is not public opinion that drives American policy off the international spectrum. Quite the opposite. Opinion is much closer to the global norm than the U.S. government's policies reflect, and much more supportive of actions needed to confront the likely environmental disaster predicted by an overwhelming scientific consensus, and one that's not too far off. Huge majorities have favored steps by the federal government to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions generated when utilities produce electricity. The fact that the public is influenced by science is deeply troubling to those who dominate the economy and state policy. One current illustration of their concern is the Environmental Literacy Improvement Act, proposed to state legislatures by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a corporate-funded lobby that designs legislation to serve the needs of the corporate sector and extreme wealth. The ALEC Act mandates balanced teaching of climate science in K through 12 classrooms. Balanced teaching is a code phrase that refers to teaching climate change denial. It is analogous to the balanced teaching advocated by creationists to enable the teaching of creation science in public schools. Of course, all of this is dressed up in rhetoric about teaching critical thinking, a fine idea, no doubt. But it's easy to think up far better examples than an issue that has been selected because of its importance in terms of corporate profits. Media reports commonly present a controversy between two sides on climate change. One side consists of the overwhelming majority of scientists, the world's major international academies of science, the professional science journals, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They agree that global warming is taking place, that there is a substantial human component, and that the situation is serious and perhaps dire, and that very soon, maybe within decades, the world might reach a tipping point where the process will escalate sharply with severe social and economic effects. The other side consists of skeptics, including a few respected scientists, who caution that much is unknown, which means that things might not be as bad as thought, or they might be worse. Omitted from the contrived debate is a much larger group of skeptics, highly regarded climate scientists who see the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's regular reports as much too conservative. And these scientists have repeatedly been proven correct, unfortunately. That is presumably why sectors of the corporate world are launching their attack on the educational system in an effort to counter the public's dangerous tendency to pay attention to the conclusions of scientific research. Within the really existing capitalist democracy system, it is of extreme importance that we become the stupid nation, not misled by science and rationality, in the interest of the short-term gains of the masters of the economy and political system, and damn the consequences. These commitments are deeply rooted in the fundamentalist market doctrines so as to sustain a powerful state that serves wealth and power. The externality that has been ignored is the fate of the species. In future, historians, if there are any, will look back on this curious spectacle taking shape in the early 21st century. For the first time in human history, humans are facing the significant prospect of severe calamity as a result of their actions, actions that are battering our prospects of decent survival. Those historians will observe that the richest and most powerful country in the history, which enjoys incomparable advantages, is leading the effort to intensify the likely disaster. Leading the effort to preserve conditions in which our immediate descendants might have a decent life are the so-called primitive societies, First Nations, tribal, indigenous, aboriginal. The countries with large and influential indigenous populations are well in the lead in seeking to preserve the planet. The countries that have driven indigenous populations to extinction or extreme marginalization are racing toward destruction. Thus, Ecuador, with its large indigenous population, is seeking aid from the rich countries to allow it to keep its substantial oil reserves underground where they should be. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Canada are seeking to burn fossil fuels, including the extremely dangerous Canadian tar sands, and to do so quickly and fully as possible, while they hail the wonders of a century of largely meaningless energy independence without a side glance at what would the world might look like after this extravagant commitment to self-destruction. This is all exactly the opposite of what rationality would predict, unless it is the skewed form of reason that passes through the filter of really existing capitalist democracy. That was an article by Noam Chomsky entitled "Can Civilization Survive Capitalism?" Chomsky's new book is Power Systems, Conversations on Global Democratic Uprisings and the New Challenges to U.S. Empire. He is Emeritus Professor of Linguistics and Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is Tom Becker for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. That was Tom Becker, and he read from Noam Chomsky. Again, I just want to remind everyone that the pledge drive is coming up. If you like the Old Mole Variety Hour and if you love KBOO, do call and pledge your support. We will have thank you gifts to offer in the form of books, and you can get those by calling in and pledging your support during the membership drive. Up next, we have some segments that have been edited down by Clayton Morgeridge, Old Mole. Bill Resnick will be, he was at the Save the Postal Workers rally yesterday and recorded lots of activists and speakers. Thank you so much. Let's get it going.
Moscow! Down the hill, Moscow! Excellent! Now we're warmed up. And it's 2 o'clock. Let's begin! We appreciate all of you being here. We're so grateful for the sunshine today.
So I'm with the Communities and Postal Workers United, a national network of coalitions to save America's postal service.
Letter carriers are literally blue-collar employees. We're middle-class people. You know, we don't earn a lot, but we earn enough to keep a roof over our heads, feed our families, and save enough money to send our children to college. And I want people to know that the Postal Service is the largest employer of veterans outside the military. And any cuts to service would be a cut to veterans' jobs and to middle-class jobs. And it's the middle class that supports, it's the infrastructure of our economy. We spend money, we earn money, we spend money. Yes, we do provide a very important service. We are a link within our community. Personally, I deliver to a very large mobile home park, and there's a lot of elderly people in my park, and they depend on me. They depend on me to be a contact. Sometimes the only thing they, or the only people they talk to is me, you know, because they don't have a lot of family left. They depend on me for their medication, for their correspondence. I check on them, you know, when I go by their homes, make sure they're okay. And we tell each other what's going on in the community. We take care of each other. And I think that's really lost in our community of internet and telephones and computers, that we don't have that personal connection. Any private organization always looks for the cream of the crop, and that's what they're going to do. They may skim off the very high income areas, but those poor people and those people in rural areas, their service or lack thereof, the prices are going to skyrocket, because the private market can determine and change prices on a whim. Whereas if the Postal Service wants to change a price, it takes over a year. We have to go through meetings and hearings and justify it, and everybody gets a chance to comment. A UPS, FedEx can change their price overnight without answering to anybody. Because we're federal employees, we're not allowed to discriminate or say, oh, I don't like this neighborhood or I don't like that customer, and so I'm going to deny them service. We can't do that. We serve everybody equally. And that's something that a private company will not do. Rural communities really depend on the Postal Service as a conduit for what's going on in their community. Usually the small post offices especially, that's the only link to bigger cities and outside areas and big companies like Amazon to get things to them, is to go through their Postal Service to get service. And that's something that would... Some rural areas might have to travel 10, 15, 20, 30 miles to the nearest post office if the small post offices close.
All of us need to broaden and deepen this movement to save the Postal Service. I'm glad to be here in solidarity.
Postal Service is under attack. What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
Postal Service is under attack. What do?
Stand up, fight back!
Postal workers are under attack. What do?
Stand up, fight back!
Postal customers are under attack. What do?
Stand up, fight back!
Good afternoon. I'm Scotty Fairchild. I represent LIUNA, Labor's 483. And we are the men and women who help to maintain the city. Your roads, your sidewalks, your parks, your sewage systems, stormwater systems. And we are here to proudly endorse the letter carriers, the work that they do. The government and the corporations of this country have been reducing services to the people on the ground, the citizens, the community, more and more every day. This is just another step we need to take to stand up and let them know that we're here to be represented and you're honored. If we start to let the Postal Service down and the city workers down, what can we expect next? It's time to hold the corporations accountable, the banks accountable, and our governments accountable, especially when we have such a warring imperialist economy. Thank you.
It all comes down to money. Comes down to making profit. The reality is that what the Postal Service does, about half of what the post office does, is extremely profitable. And the private sector would love nothing more than to be able to take that over and have that profit go into private pockets. The downfall of that is that the very profitable portions of the Postal Service are there to cover the non-profitable portions, basically your rural communities, your poorer communities, delivery for the blind, things of that nature. And so all of this attempt to damage and cut back and shrink the post office is designed so it will make it easier for private corporations to come in, take over the profitable portions, and make it so that the post office just dies that much quicker and gets out of the way. And that will basically just cause loss for all of this country. There's nobody that will not feel that in one way or the other, whether it be seeing your neighbor across the street not getting their medication in an affordable, timely manner, everybody's costs of shipping potentially skyrocketing. Very, very few instances of the privatization have resulted in people being able to save money. It usually means that costs go up, that the cost for the consumer increases. Once it's gone, it's gone. It's not going to come back. The cost of putting a network like the post office has together is too great. No private company would ever do such an outreach to cover every single address and be in every single town in this entire country. Once it's gone, it's gone. We won't have it anymore. It's that simple. The crippling started with the financial requirements that Congress straddled the post office with in 2006. That's what has resulted in the post office showing these huge financial losses, which allows people to shout out and say, the post office is failing, we must shut it down, we got to break it up. It's going to cost taxpayers money, which isn't true. It doesn't cost taxpayers any money. Right now, as a letter carrier, the one thing I do every single day of the week is deliver medication from the VA to a veteran on my route every single day. You start eliminating days of delivery, you start delaying the mails, the Postal Service would probably not be allowed to continue to deliver medication because the FDA would be afraid that things sitting there might expire. So you'd be cutting off affordable delivery of medication to veterans, to senior citizens, to people, all walks of life that need this medication simply to survive. And if you cut away the Postal Service, you cut away the affordable, equal access that everybody in this country has, from veterans to senior citizens to anybody that needs medication on a daily basis. And you start cutting it away at the Postal Service and you start taking that medication from those people. If they run out of medication and they have to wait through the weekend, and then if there's a national holiday and they're sitting there for 4 days without their medication, that could in some cases be fatal. The Postal Service has always been the connector of the community. I feel it, especially given the fact that the route that I deliver is in the neighborhood I live in. I am very much a part of my neighborhood. I rely on the people around me, and I know the people around me rely on me to be there every day. We enable communication. We help to bind the nation together. That's why the post office was founded. Was with that principle that we needed a network of communications that would bind our nation and keep it together. And all that's happening is trying to break that down and make us as individuals be that much more separate. And that just it just breaks my heart to see that happening. So the reason the post office is suffering is because we're the only company, public or private, in the entire country that is required to 100% pre-fund all of its retiree health care benefits 75 years into the future. And that has to be done over a 10-year period. So the post office, beginning in 2007, the law was passed in the lame duck session of 2006 at the very end there. Starting 2007, the post office went from a business that is designed to break even to a business that is designed to break even and also make a payment of over $5.5 billion into a fund every year. And that's where that financial loss has come from, is from that payment. Congress holds the future of the Postal Service in their hands. They can save it or they can destroy it. And the only way they're going to finally do the right thing is if they hear from enough of us, enough citizens, to finally let them know how important it is that we maintain our structure, that we allow the post office to not only maintain six-day delivery, not only keep these rural post offices open, not only keep the processing plants open so that mails are delivered still in a quick, timely manner. The post office is hampered. We are not allowed to do so many services that we could do. The post office needs to be given the freedom and the flexibility to, in the rural postal locations, offer services, offer governmental licensing, offer other essential services that right now people in rural areas have to drive, in some cases, hundreds of miles to get access to. Why not use the internet access that is in those post offices and make it available to the public so that people that need to have access to whether it be banking online or things of that nature, so they could go into a rural post office and do that. I would love it if we picked up medicines that were phoned into the local pharmacy and delivered them to people the exact same day.
Okay, well, we had to cut that a little short this morning because here at the Old Mole Variety Hour, we work as hard as we possibly can to cram as much as we possibly can into these 60 minutes that we have allotted to bring you news, views, perspectives, and information that maybe you wouldn't otherwise hear. Today, I want to thank Bill Resnick, Tom Becker, Clayton Morgeridge, and Ivan Hale, and I guess that's me. I can thank myself. Sure, why not? And Gayasi Ross for giving us insightful piece, and Noam Chomsky for being Noam Chomsky. And thank you to you, the listener of KABU. Have a great week, and stay tuned for more. Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, March 18th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Why the big rush to build a bridge that's supposed to last 100 years? And I quote,
And yet today is not high enough to accommodate river shipping. And another question. Why are hatchery fish being released into the scrum of dwindling wild stock? A rare ruling comes our way this Wednesday, preliminary to a big decision that affects fish in our rivers. And the European Union has stepped forward to grant the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank about $2.8 million, that's about $3 million to pay pensions and salaries. How that It's something, but it's certainly not enough to address the horrific situation that the Palestinians are in. Haven't been paid now for, I believe it's 3 months, perhaps more. The National Weather Service has this for us first. Today, scattered showers early, but we don't see that. Otherwise, mostly sunny with a high near 53. Not much in the way of winds. And for tonight, the clouds moving in with a low around 40. Tomorrow, rain expected. Mainly in the morning with a high near 53 and let's see, overnight lows around 46. Breezy though, Tuesday night, tomorrow night, expect south winds 7 to 12 miles an hour, amping up to 21 to 26 by evening. Gusts could hit 38 miles per hour tomorrow night. That's something. Alternative forecast, we don't have that today because it's holding pretty much steady. And now we're going to news from around Cascadia. We are first up. We have this. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife accidentally, right, released at least 250 hatchery juvenile spring chinook into the Bull Run River. This against a federal court agreement. When a so-called properly installed screen on an acclimation pond tour. The Native Fish Society this week on Wednesday is asking a federal federal judge to stop Oregon's seasonal release of juvenile salmon and steelhead into the Sandy River. This is somewhat of a precedent. This sets a precedent. Here to talk about it with us this morning is Mike Moody, Director, head of the Native Fish Society. Good morning, Mike. We're very happy to have you with us. Good morning.
Chris?
Yes, good morning.
Yep, good morning. I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This ruling comes before the results of a massive lawsuit, a significant lawsuit that the Native Fish Society has launched. Can you talk a little bit about what happened, this accident? When we learn of these sort of accidents, it is naturally suspicious minds would say, well, you know, there have been efforts to claim that the hatchery fish are exactly the same as wild fish, and this is